Sam was, he actually was an influence on me, both his writings and also just in speaking to him for the book. He told me when he did the Country Blues book that his goal was to get people to be passionate about this music. You know, he had a social goal. You know, he wanted to bring attention to these very deserving masters of this music. And so he told me that he kind of wrote it to stir people up. And that really stuck with me, actually. And so when I set about to finally do the writing of the book, I was keeping that in mind, that I really wanted to get people to notice Reverend Gary Davis, who hadn't noticed him before.
Well, while we're on the subject of Sam, there is a section in the book about the work he did with Reverend Gary Davis for the Prestige label. Can you talk a little bit about that specific work? Because it is mentioned in his book, The Bluesmakers.
Sam was brought in by Prestige in 1964 to work with Reverend Gary Davis. And by then, Davis had already recorded three classic records for Prestige. And they were produced by a man named Kenny Goldstein, who was probably the preeminent producer during the folk revival. And they were wonderful records, to be sure, but Kenny and Reverend Gary Davis didn't really have a very strong rapport. I think that Kenny Goldstein wasn't particularly touchy-feely, and they kind of were at cross purposes at times. And so it's no surprise that Goldstein didn't get Reverend Gary Davis to sing any secular songs or record any secular songs, which was always the goal of everyone who worked with Davis. And then Sam Charters comes in, as I said, in 1964, and he brings a different sensibility, I think, to the recording. Part of it is just his personality, which was, you know, easygoing and very deferential, and I think that relaxed Davis quite a bit. And so Charters was able to coax a very unique record from Davis, and that is a record of all secular music, instrumentals, but ragtime and blues and the stuff that he had really refused to record up until that time, you know, ever since he'd become ordained as a minister. So it was an interesting session.
That was a constant issue, as you detail in the book, of his hesitancy to record secular music and sometimes even perform it, even though that's what most people who wanted to hear him and learn from him were wanting to get from him.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Davis led kind of a double life during the folk revival. I mean, he considered himself first and foremost an evangelist. He was out to save souls. That's what motivated him. But the people who worked with him during that period really wanted to hear not only his gospel music, but also his blues and ragtime and other secular music. And so Davis was reluctant to do that for a very long time. And in fact, right around the time that Sam Charters recorded him was when he started to loosen up in that regard, I would say. He began to understand that he was an entertainer. Even though he was a minister, you know, when he was out on the stage and when he was in the recording studio, he decided that he needed to give people a little more of what they wanted, especially if he was going to be invited back. And, you know, music was really what was earning him and his wife enough to survive on at first, and then eventually to buy a house in Queens. So he relaxed his prohibition on the blues, and this was really the beginning of it, the record he did with Sam Charters.
At the same time, he was a great teacher, and he had a lot of students. Many of them are well known. Talk about how you were able to speak with a lot of those people and learn so much about what he was as a person.
Yeah, well, Davis, you know, he probably had his greatest influence as a teacher. And he taught his whole life, you know, beginning with when he was at the blind school in South Carolina, and then when he lived in Durham, North Carolina, he tutored Blind Boy Fuller, who went on to become one of the best-selling bluesmen before World War II. And then during the folk revival, he taught probably hundreds of students who came knocking on his door, both in the Bronx and later in Queens, to learn his guitar style. And, you know, many of them were just hobbyists who never went on to become famous, but then there were the people who were going to become famous or who were already famous when they sought him out. And they included people like Bob Ware of the Grateful Dead, and Dion, Steve Katz of Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Dave Van Ronk, Janis Ian, Ry Cooder, David Bromberg. I mean, the list goes on. He had quite an influence. Then there were the people, of course, who didn't take formal lessons, but who soaked up his music and recorded it, like Bob Dylan and Jorma Kekkonen of the Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuna. And his students, you know, Davis didn't keep a diary or anything. He was a semi-literate blind man. So for me, in terms of writing my book, I really relied heavily on the people who were coming to his house every day and speaking with him and finding out what was on his mind to help tell his story. So that was very, very important in the writing of the book.
You have a great story about Eric Clapton, which I'd like you to retell. It was in the book, I guess, towards the end.
So when Davis was doing his second tour of England in 1965, he was being taken around to the gigs by a young man who was the tour manager. And the man hadn't really heard of Davis much. And when he picked him up from the airport, one of the first things he did was take Davis to a guitar shop in London to get Davis some new guitar strings. And when they got there was a young man who was at the counter being waited on, and he saw Davis and asked Davis to play some tunes, which Davis did. And then after he was done, he asked the young man if he would play a few songs himself, and the man said, "Oh, well, I could never play in your presence." And as they were walking out, the tour manager asked the guy at the counter who the young man was, and he said, "Oh, that was Eric Clapton." So I guess even young guitar gods get nervous on occasion.
Well, I'm always interested in hearing how Clapton reacts, because he went through a lot himself, managed to survive it. But it was in 1994 that he began to really go back and make his first blues record, which was From the Cradle. And that became the first blues record to hit number one, which helped re-revive the blues.
If it weren't for people like Eric Clapton, I think, you know, a lot of the music would be forgotten, which is a shame. But, you know, that's how our society works.
One of the things about Reverend Gary Davis is his style of playing that I guess Jorma Kekkonen is perhaps the best example of it, because of how much he's worked with that material and performed it. Could you describe it for us?
Well, Davis plays in a style that's known as the Piedmont style of guitar, and it's a very syncopated rhythmic style that derives from piano ragtime and old-time banjo. And when Davis was coming up, you know, he played in string bands. These were bands that entertained at picnics and dances and parties, and you had to be able to get people's feet moving to the beat of the music. So it was very utilitarian when it started. But Davis took this style probably to its most sophisticated level. His approach to the guitar was so limitless, and his conception so far beyond that of most of his blues peers. I mean, while most of them could play in a couple of keys, usually E and A, and maybe they knew a smattering of tunes in other keys, Davis could play in any key up and down the neck. And he, you know, when he wanted to recreate the sound of an entire marching band, he went and did it. And when he wanted to recreate the sound of a church choir, he went and did it on his sixth string. So I think a lot of what his students, people like Jorma Kekkonen and Bob Ware of the Grateful Dead, learned from Davis was to treat the guitar without limitations. And if you want your guitar to sound like an orchestra or a saxophone or or a piano, then go ahead and do that. And I think they really took that to heart.
Obviously, yeah. Because you've devoted an entire book and all the time and research it took to put it together, you think there's a legacy for Reverend Gary Davis. Do you think this is going to help perhaps bring some new interest to him? Because I know musicians know him, but perhaps maybe the general public doesn't.
Well, I hope it does. I mean, that was one of my goals when I set out to write the book. Again, talking about Sam Charters, you know, trying to get people interested in this kind of music and in Davis in particular. I mean, is Davis's music suddenly going to shoot to the top of the charts? No, I don't think that that's really probable. But we are in the middle of, I won't call it a folk revival because I think that's probably too strong, but there's certainly been some renewed interest lately in folk music, groups like Mumford & Sons and the Lumineers, and with the Coen brothers adapting Dave Van Ronk's story into a movie. You know, there is more interest in this kind of music than there was, say, 5-10 years ago. And so I do hope that it brings some attention to Davis. I think he's one of the great musicians of the 20th century, and I would certainly like him to be more of a household name than he has been in the past.